Hi guys, and welcome back to the Image Junkies podcast with me, Christian Parkinson, aka at Image Junkies with an IES. Today we've got a good one. We're talking to a video journalist from AFP called Pak Yu. He's currently based in China and has some really interesting tales. We're going to talk about what it's like covering Xinjiang, I think that's how you say it, the Muslim area of China where he's not long returned from, and all the escapades he got up to actually trying to film anything there because it's an incredibly difficult place to operate. We then talk about something that's still very relevant, which is covering the demonstrations in Hong Kong, which since we spoke have flared up again and seem to still be ongoing. There doesn't look to be an immediate end in sight to that. And then finally, we finish with a bit of a geek out. We talk about the DJI Osmo Pocket, which we both have, and I wax lyrical about the Insta360 One X. It's a pretty good chit-chat. So without further ado, let's get going.
I'm Pak, and I grew up between Australia and Hong Kong. Currently, I'm a video journalist based in Beijing, but covering China and Mongolia. And so I guess my day-to-day job really is to go cover various breaking news, daily events, and the occasional feature stories that come out of both countries. Previously, before I was in Beijing, I was in Hong Kong for about 3 years. It definitely has been a bit of a transition moving from Hong Kong, where I guess press freedom is a bit more liberal, and coming to Beijing, which is a completely different environment.
Well, I was going to ask about that later, but as we've kind of segued into it, we can jump around a bit. So, I mean, what is the differences you've noticed, and not just specifically between Hong Kong and working in mainland China, but just in general, how difficult is it to operate?
I think most of us are quite aware of China's track record when it comes to press freedom, but working in China is completely different. The environment is very it's quite tough in many ways, especially for visual journalists, people who work, you know, with a camera, photographers, cameramen, video journalists. And that's because the government really likes to control the narrative and the information that comes out of the country. Having worked in Australia and Hong Kong, where we get a lot of help from the government when it comes to getting information, getting access. Beijing, on the other hand, it's very different. They like to keep us in the dark when it comes to major press events, major state visits, and they don't really tell us until the very last minute. And so that's been an adjustment. And I guess also
sorry to cut you off. I'm just kind of interested on that point. Would you say is that specifically the foreign press, or are they just the same with all press, whether you're local, foreign? You know, anyone except state media, I guess, or is it specifically foreign press?
I think it's more geared towards foreign press. State media, they get access that foreign and more local kind of independently operating media. So the state media definitely have a lot more access compared to us. Yeah, there is a bit of a struggle when it comes to just getting information. We're treated very differently. We have to go through the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, as well as various different departments like the Propaganda Department. The whole thing is very bureaucratic, and it's designed to make it very difficult
to break your will.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I was talking to a friend the other day about what it's like working in China, and it's not so much physically exhausting like it was back in Hong Kong, but I think here it's just it takes a huge psychological toll on you, really.
Yeah. And is it sort of very subtle things, you know, like not telling you about press conferences and things like that? Or is actually filming on the street difficult as well? Or is it quite easy just to take a camera out on the street and film things?
It's definitely both. I think as someone who works with a camera, you can kind of walk around with a camera. I tend to bring smaller cameras with me. So I have the Sony A7S and as well as a Sony FS5, which is a little bit more compact compared to some of those ENG cameras. Filming in the public is allowed, but then again, it also depends on the topic that you cover. And more often than not, the state kind of knows when you're going to cover this, you know, certain sensitive topics. So it's really much, it's really just a game of cat and mouse, really. You kind of have to outsmart the government.
Yeah, wow. And do they expect you to have sort of government minders and things, or it's not as full on as that? It's a bit more relaxed.
Depends on me. This year has been a particularly interesting year for China. It's, you know, it's the year of anniversaries. You know, it's the anniversary of the Tibetan uprising, the 30th anniversary of the Tiananmen crackdown, and so on. And so this year has been particularly stressful when it comes to going out and covering stories. But I also recently went to Xinjiang, and that covering Xinjiang was completely different. It just so out of this world. And like you said, yeah, we had government minders the entire time. We had plainclothes police following us. The whole process, the whole assignment was very stressful. And so you've got to be very careful in terms of when you whip out that camera and when you start filming.
For people who don't know, then, this area you're talking about, this is where is it Uyghurs are, the Muslim Chinese?
Yeah. So they're more Turkic, ethnically closely related to the Turkish people than the Han Chinese people. So there's it's been in the news quite a bit. So there is an estimated number of, I think, about a million at the moment. There's this figure going around of Uyghurs that are locked up in what the Chinese government are calling vocational education training centers. But based on numerous testimonies and people who have previously been detained, it sounds a lot more like an internment camp. Concentration camp, where they're forced to study Mandarin. There's, you know, testimonials of torture. There's this huge story going on around in Xinjiang, and the government, sorry, it's just a dog. So there's this huge story going on in Xinjiang, which the government really doesn't want to be kind of leaked and, you know, told to the rest of the world. So we did a number of reports on Xinjiang, and it had been a while for AFP, my company, to send people to Xinjiang, purely because it's so difficult to report there. You're constantly followed by minders. The moment you land, you've got almost like a welcoming party where kind of plainclothes people follow you. They basically watch your every move. And so it makes it very difficult for you to talk to people, for you to, you know, move around freely. I can't even count the number of times we were blocked and turned away from a number of cities or little towns and villages even. You know, some of these tactics that they come up with are just absolutely ridiculous, like fake car crashes or lost tourists who were asking us for directions and following us everywhere. It was just very bizarre. But these are, you know, some of these are some of the tactics that they, you know, use on reporters and basically try and prevent us from, you know, getting close to these camps or talking to people.
There's a story even in that, isn't there? Like, if you were just rolling on all of that and sort of kind of doing these little side pieces to camera, that could be quite an interesting story in itself.
Oh, yeah, visually. I mean, it was great because, you know, we spoke to other people who had been to Xinjiang before, and we made a lot of preparations. So I actually brought a GoPro to attach to the dashboard of the car that we hired. And this was another thing. Hiring a car in Xinjiang is very difficult because it's apparently mandatory for the car company to assign a driver to us. And I think we wasted about half a day trying to persuade them to let us use our own driver. And that was actually a good idea because that meant that we had a little safe space that we could, you know, discuss what we wanted to, whatever we wanted. And so I attached this camera to the dashboard, and we filmed basically a fake car crash in the making. And it was, it was just gold.
Brilliant. And I mean, once you were able to reach any of these places, were you actually able to film anything? Or, you know, did you come away from your trip feeling you actually got something, or was it impossible?
Yeah, so I think we got some great footage. The photographer and I, we kind of discussed the amount of gear that we were going to bring. There was a lot of planning involved. We needed to know which areas we needed to go to, how we were going to get there, and there was a lot of, you know, play it by ear kind of, you know, decisions. And we managed to get close enough to some of these camps. We got some good footage from afar, but there was no way possible that we were going to get anywhere near the entrance, even just to film or get close to.
Yeah. No, it's I can only empathize with you how difficult that sort of trip is. I mean, having now returned, what sort of tips and tricks have you learned that you would pass on to anyone in the same boat?
I think for video journalists and photographers, you've definitely got to bring minimal gear. I think you're a video journalist as well. I think you're quite well aware of, you know, sometimes we tend to overpack. for a lot of assignments, because you never know what kind of gear you need. And I think, you know, for this trip, we definitely packed as little as possible. I think I took one GoPro, one mirrorless camera, a zoom lens with a really nice range, a microphone, and just my laptop. I think that was it, and a gajillion batteries. I think packing light was definitely a good tip that I, you know, learned from other people and I learned on the job. I think planning is a must. There's a lot of time wasted discussing with security and the propaganda department about why we couldn't enter certain places. And I think, you know, you've got to realize that that's actually just a tactic of theirs, delaying your reporting, reducing the amount of time that you can be on the ground. So and I think there are a lot of other tips as well. I think the best one that I had was that I can tell people is to actually bring your own driver. Getting around hard enough.
So someone who knows the area, basically.
No, not even. I mean, we brought a driver from a different city, and I think having a local would put them in danger. Having someone from to drive you around, because any association with the press, especially foreign press, is a risk for them. And so that's another thing that we had to keep in mind was, you know, where was the boundary in terms of putting people on record or interacting with locals, because we had to be very well aware of any people that we were associated with, people that we spoke to. There was a risk for them to be taken away and possibly be put into these camps as well.
Right, yeah. So that's the last thing we ever want in our job, really, isn't it? Is to get someone imprisoned or worse.
Yeah. And I think that's what's... been the most difficult part about, I think, reporting in China. In Hong Kong and Australia, you know, people that I interview, you don't really think about the consequences of them talking to you. And this is, it's not just Xinjiang. A lot of human rights related stories that I've worked on, we've got to be very conscious of the fact that, you know, they are risking a lot just to even make contact with you. I don't know if it's the same with where you are.
In South Africa, no, but there are places. I mean, in South Africa, it's got a very liberal constitution. People feel very free to talk. I mean, despite the problems they have here around politics and corruption, actually, people on the street can pretty much say what they like with no fear of retribution, which is great. But I was in Sudan a couple of weeks ago, and that was, that was very much, I was concerned for the people we were filming, because, as you know, sometimes people are too brave for their own good and they insist they want to show their face. And actually it's us saying to them, are you really sure, you know, maybe just cover your face, or, you know, and you end up having to have those debates. And sometimes you have to make the decision not to show their face, even if they're really keen, you know, because it's so difficult to know what the right thing to do is. So I'm really interested. So you've also just been in Hong Kong, right? What were you covering and how was it to work there?
It was kind of nice being back on familiar ground. Like I said, I was in Hong Kong for 3 years. And, you know, it's always nice going back to the city. It's a crazy city. It's just so fun and vibrant. The people are lovely. There's just great food. And I, unfortunately, this time I was going for a work trip, and there are these huge protests that are going on in Hong Kong. That had happened in Hong Kong, and that was related to the extradition bill amendment that the government wanted to pass through. And just for a bit of background, the extradition bill amendment would have seen basically Hong Kong extraditing people that China found were lawbreakers and would send them back to the mainland. And I think a lot of the people were critical of this bill because China has very opaque, not very transparent legal system. They've had a track record of torture and detaining people arbitrarily, and persecuting people politically. And so a lot of people feared that people in Hong Kong would be taken over to the mainland. And I think initially the movement was kind of, it started off quite small, but then it gradually grew to this big protest that happened June 12th, when the police started firing rounds and rounds of tear gas. And they actually also, I think for the first time, shot rounds of beanbag bullets, which is very rare. I should add that, you know, Hong Kong is a international financial center, and they've had, you know, Hong Kong does have a track record of protests, demonstrations, marches, and most of them have been quite peaceful. It's only been the last couple few weeks actually where things have really escalated and the police have kind of just cracked down, and it really was a different experience covering the recent protests compared to the ones that I've covered before.
Yeah, I mean, what I saw on TV, that it looked, I mean, amazing in terms of numbers. I mean, how was it to film? Were you stopped by the police? Were the demonstrators friendly? I mean, how was it on the street?
Yeah, so it was just such a breath of fresh air going back to Hong Kong. There's actually this team called the Media Liaison Team, and they actually are deployed to help media get access to certain areas during these protests. And
these were protesters useful. Themselves, were they?
No, so they're a private group. They're not related to the protesters, they're not related to the government, but basically they kind of make sure that press are safe.
Oh, that's good.
They get access to areas that, yeah, it's just completely different to the mainland. But yeah, so that was just completely, it was just so nice to be able to report freely. For the protesters, I mean, there were 2 million people, and I think the way we covered it was we deployed, I think about six different video journalists in total. We did about 3 lives for clients from different vantage points, and I was kind of roaming around on the ground with the protesters. So wherever they went, I kind of followed. And the protesters were so kind. There's this real sense of community. They are very friendly to the press. And I mean, when I say friendly, I mean it's hot. It's hot in Hong Kong. It's extremely hot and very humid. And there's a lot of walking around. So these protesters have actually built these little stations, water stations and material stations where they'll hand out bottles of waters to the press. I think there was one night where I kind of worked over 12 hours, and these 2 protesters came up to me with a bowl of fruit and said, you know, stop, you've got to stop eating, you know, instant noodles and McDonald's, and you should have some fruit. It was really sweet. And these are protesters that I think, you know, they've all come out, and I think they've seen, you know, protests overseas, and, you know, it does get quite chaotic in other countries. And I think they wanted to make sure that they were perceived that they are peaceful protesters, and they're, you know, the citizens of Hong Kong. They were cleaning up after themselves. They were, you know, it was just amazing to see that sense of community.
Yeah, wow. The rest of the world could really learn something from that. If only everywhere was like that.
Yeah, I mean, I was surprised. They occupied, you know, numbers, quite a number of main roads that basically stopped traffic in the city center, and nothing was, you know, no shops were destroyed. Nothing was looted. When they left, it was clean. It was spotless.
Wow, that's amazing. And when you're doing something like that, especially given the heat and the amount of walking you're doing, which of your cameras and what kit do you carry around with you when you're following some sort of event like that?
So I guess with this particular protest, and I guess most protests, I generally take the Sony PXW 100. It's kind of like a mini ENG.
And, yes. Okay. I think I know the one you mean. Is it? Because I've got the Z90, which I think is like the slightly updated version of that. I could be wrong, but they're sort of like almost like palm size camcorders, right?
A little bit bigger. Right. Yeah. You can attach the XR cables into them and put an SDI cable for lives as well. So I take that around with me, as well as a monopod, plenty of batteries, because you don't really know, you know, how long this thing will last. A monopod and my protective gear, really, and a laptop to file.
So you usually expect it to file from right in amongst stuff. There's no sort of heading back to the office to file.
No. I mean, luckily, the AFP offices were kind of close to the protest area, and I think the government had signal jammers where, you know, nothing was really going through. But more often than not, yes, working for a news agency means you've got to file as quickly as possible. And so I take my laptop with me everywhere, and I filed on the field basically as soon as something happens. You film it, you go to you find a kind of quiet, safe area, file, and then you go back. I think the news operations, the video operations at a news agencies are much larger, and I think we had people on the desk taking footage that were coming in from various spots around the protest area, and they were compiling it, and then that would then land onto the wider surface.
Okay, gotcha. All right. Well, sounds like they kept you very busy.
Yeah, there were long days, but you know, exciting times. I think you'd agree that, you know, being a video journalist and a cameraman means that you have to be, you know, in and amongst the action. And it's, yeah, I think we're quite privileged in the sense that we get to witness all of this unfold.
Yeah, no, that's true. And it's so nice when you're at an event where you don't really have to force anything, where you can just point the camera and get nice shots, and you're not having to direct, and the stress of, like you say, negotiating through roadblocks or, you know, messing around. You can just stick the camera in there and get good shots. And it's so rare we get that these days.
Yeah. I think it depends. Yeah, I guess it depends on what you cover, really. Hong Kong was, I think, this is the other thing. Hong Kong, the people in Hong Kong protesters are incredibly savvy. They're very witty. And they're very creative as well. So they, you know, the use of umbrellas during the protest, that was just extremely visual. They use them as kind of shields from tear gas and pepper spray, as well as batons. The entire thing was quite visually stunning as well, you know, compared to our other protests.
I'm jealous.
Yeah. It's quite stunning and just very different. You know, just across the border. Just across the border in mainland, there's, you know, everything was censored. It was just really bizarre.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like a great story to have worked on. And do you think, just sort of throwing forward, I'm not sure what the latest is. Are these demonstrations the start of something big, or do you think it's just going to peter out now and, you know, nothing will change?
I think the protesters have kind of learned from the 2014 umbrella movement, when they occupied the CBD area for about, I think it was 79 days. This time they're kind of organizing sporadic, spontaneous protests in different areas of the city. And I think what's different about this protest is that it's leaderless. There's no one face of the demonstrations. It's it really is quite grassroots, and they all have one main demand, and that's really for the government to withdraw the bill amendment. Unfortunately, the government hasn't really quite outright said that they would withdraw. They've been using various words and sayings to kind of say, you know, the bill is dead. But I think the protesters really do want the government to just outright say, you know, bill is withdrawn. And until that happens, I think people will continue to protest.
Yeah. I mean, one thing you mentioned that I found interesting, you said you went in sort of switching back to kit. Sorry to be a kit bore. You mentioned you went in with a monopod. I'm also a big fan of monopods, actually, and I also travel very light most of the time. But one thing I never understand, and I still see it now, and I almost want to just grab them by the scruff of the neck, is when I see guys with big cameras and big tripods going into the middle of a demonstration or a march, and I just think, mate, leave your tripod. What is wrong with you? Like, you know, I think a monopod, especially with a small camera, is a nice middle ground. You know, you can get your steady shots. But I never understand guys who carry tripods into war zones or riots or huge marches. I mean, did you miss your tripod?
No, not at all. I actually don't quite understand the logic of bringing a tripod, really. Because I guess, you know, the protests are, you know, happen quickly. You're moving around all the time. I don't quite understand why you'd bring a tripod. I'm not a huge fan of a monopod, to be honest, but it is very useful in these scenarios.
Yeah, no, exactly. And then talking of kit, I saw on your Twitter page, you've got that really nice film pinned to the top of your page that you shot on your Osmo Pocket. I just wondered if you've been using that a lot and how you've got on with it.
Yeah, that is by far the best purchase I've made. And I would highly recommend it for anyone who wants to, you know, anyone who's in the video industry. It's so tiny. It's the size of your palm. It has a built-in gimbal, so it stabilizes your shots. It shoots in 4K. And it's just a nifty little equipment that has, you know, time-lapse options, slow-mo options. It's by far the best thing I've used. I took it on a road trip I did around Sichuan, and I decided to, it was kind of the first time I was really playing around with it. I bought it for the trip, really, and when I bought it, I hadn't had any time to use it, so I think I was kind of learning to use the equipment while I was filming, and the outcome, the quality of the video is just, it's insane for something so small. The best thing about it is because you can shoot, subtly. You're not pointing a camera, you're not pointing a lens in someone's face. And I think that really does make, you know, your subjects feel a lot more comfortable.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I have one. I haven't used it that much professionally. But what I did find it useful for was exactly what you're saying. I wanted to get a sequence inside the airport when I was traveling a few weeks ago on a story. I mean, it wasn't anything hectic. It was just a couple of shots. And I just got the pocket out, used it a couple of times. No one even blinked. No one looked at me. Whereas obviously, if I'd have got my bigger cameras out and started filming, I'm sure someone would have come over and started asking me questions.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the beauty of technology. It's constantly changing. I think we all have to adapt to it. I think we have to constantly, you know, be adapting to the new technology. And even phones nowadays, you know, you can film 4K. It's incredible. So, yeah, it's very helpful in those sort of situations where, you know, you go to an airport and, you know, you can kind of film on the side.
Yeah. Exactly. And any other bits of kit you've been using that that you'd recommend for people? Like any other new, you know, any other new stuff you've been testing or using?
Not recently. I actually just bought the Rode Wireless Go. I don't know if you've seen that. It's like a little tiny microphone wireless transmitter.
Is that the little square-shaped one?
Yeah. So I haven't received it yet. It's coming sometime this month.
Okay, because it's quite cheap, isn't it? It's only like $250 or something.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit less than $250. It's like around $200. But yeah, it's incredibly cheap. The quality looks good. I'm excited to use it. I mean, when I film on my Sony A7S, it's having the Sennheiser transmitter on top. Kind of, it's a bit clunky, and I like mobility. I like to, you know, pack light, especially you know, in China where you kind of want to be filming as subtle as possible. So yeah, fingers crossed they work. I've seen some great reviews. So yeah, I mean, I've been quite standard with my gear. I don't.
The only other bit of kit I've got recently that's been quite fun that I've been enjoying is the Insta360 1X. Have you seen that?
Oh, yeah, the 360 camera, right?
Yeah, so it's a little 360 camera, but what's really good about it is you transfer the file once you've shot it to the app. And then in the app, you can speed it up, you can slow it down, you can choose if you still want it 360, or you can decide on the field of view. And I've been using it in my pieces, and it's really good. I mean, it's the image quality isn't amazing. I think it's 5.4K, which sounds great, but obviously that's spread over a 360 image, so it's actually a lot less once you crop in. But it's really good. You stick it on a selfie stick and it allows you to get almost drone-like shots. You know, you can hold the selfie stick up high and walk around, and it's almost like you've got a drone hovering low over a crowd or something. And it's, the stabilization is amazing. I mean, it's better than a gimbal in some ways. So it's really worth looking at, especially if you're looking for like undercovery type stuff, you know, stuff where you want to be discreet, because you could stick it in your front pocket. It would film everything that's happening in pretty much all directions. And no one would even, they'd just think it was a phone in your pocket. You know, no one would even look twice at it. If it was like wedged in your jean pocket with the camera facing forward, obviously half the shot would just be, your trousers, but the other half of the shot would be picking up everything, be really good for if you're having an argument with an official and you don't want him to see you're filming, but you just want to try and capture something on tape. It's really good.
That's really interesting. I've never really played around with 360 video, because personally, I don't know whether or not it would actually take off. And so when these cameras started being developed, I was like, oh, okay, it's something that I didn't really think too much about. But that actually sounds quite useful.
Yeah, I mean,
the fact that you can crop it.
Exactly. I mean, I'm with you. I have no interest in 360 video. I find it boring to watch. I've got no interest in making, films in 360, but to be able to capture in 360 and then choose your own framing in post, I think there's a lot of really good uses for.
Yeah. I don't really know if 360 videos are still a thing. Do you?
Well, I mean, I think there are some companies trying. I mean, I know the BBC still do the odd big project, but I don't know if that's just the sort of last twitch of a dying body. And, the BBC is such a huge beast that someone once told me it's like an aircraft carrier, very powerful, but takes a long time to change direction. So, this may be the last twitch of the dead body of 360 video. I'm not sure. But yeah, personally, I don't know anyone who likes it. I think VR, once we get to the stage where people are able to, use an Oculus Rift at home, then that's a different story. But 360 video, where you're just moving your phone around or with one of those silly cardboard headsets, I think boring, absolutely no interest.
Yeah, I think it'll take some time for sure. I know AP were playing around with it for a while, and I think they were doing it for some clients, but I think it was, a huge moneymaker.
No, exactly. So yeah, it's not something I'm keen on, but I quite enjoy this camera. I recommend it for what you do. You might find it quite useful, quite fun.
Yeah, I'll have to look into it. I mean, I still swear by this DJI Osmo Pocket. It's incredible. The video's on my Twitter. And I think, that was shot entirely on that thing. It was great fun. It's also a bit of a challenge when you tell yourself you've got to film with one piece of equipment.
Yeah, it's quite nice, isn't it? I think my problem is I have paralysis by analysis sometimes in that, I'll say to myself, well, I really want to shoot on a phone, but then I start panicking, thinking, yeah, but I really want it to look amazing, so now I best take my gimbal, and then, oh, well, I may as well take my mirrorless, and then, oh, well, if I'm taking my mirrorless, I may as well take my other camera, and before you know it, I've got four cameras on me, and kind of my original concept has kind of gone, fallen by the wayside.
Yeah. Do you still use your gimbal a lot?
Not a lot. I'll use it. I mean, I take it with me quite a bit, and I'll use it maybe four or five shots in a piece at most. Let's say a 3-minute piece. If I do get it out, maybe I'll use it for like three or four shots. I mean, I'm not one of these who wants to use the gimbal for everything. I think like a drone or like anything else, I think you can overuse them. And like you go on YouTube and every sort of, YouTube filmmaker, all their shots are just slow-mo on a gimbal. That's all they do. And it's, it was fun for the first year and now it just looks a bit cliched.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I almost bought a gimbal but I decided not to. And actually, I think that was a good decision because they're quite expensive, and I think I don't know how much use I would get out of it.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I think I like them for is, you know, I don't know how often you have to do it working for an agency, but you know, your sort of traditional piece to camera, you know, with the reporter talking to the camera. Yeah, I like using gimbals for that because it just allows you to do a bit of nice movement and it looks quite cinematic. And if you only do it for the piece to camera in a piece, it kind of makes it stand out and look interesting, you know, which I quite like. But I don't use it a lot for sort of general views and just sort of normal sequences. I'll just bring it out maybe for something like that, like a piece to camera that I want to stand out, or, you know, something along those lines.
Yeah, I think that's probably a very good use for it. We don't have to do that for news agency, but that would definitely make a difference because the last thing you want is to watch a reporter talking on camera while shaking.
Okay, well, thanks to Pak there. I think that was a really good interview packed with some useful takeaways. If you enjoyed the podcast, do give me a follow on social media where I'm at Image Junkies with an IES. And please do comment and share the link for this podcast because it really helps. And I'd love for more people to listen and for it to grow. All right, guys, take care. And do drop me a line if you've got any questions or queries or if you want to be interviewed.